Hi, welcome to this week's program. So many people think the stock market is like some big gambling hall. And to some it is. Hedge funds and day traders and the like all look at the numbers whizzing by on their screens and make microsecond bets trying to outsmart the next guy. Let me say that using the words poker and investing in the same breath is really truly distasteful to me. I spend my days teaching clients and listeners that investing is not about beating the market, but rather using a disciplined long-term process for achieving financial and life goals. So making any parallel between gambling and investing is strictly verboten in my book. But the fact that I do have to work so hard to distinguish between investing and gambling suggests that, like it or not, there must be some parallels. So let's see if we can find them and learn the good, bad, and the ugly. Maybe we can become better investors after all. So I spent time looking into the fundamentals of poker and noticed that there are indeed some healthy strategic strategies that we can add to our own investing toolbox. These strategies may serve us well, both in poker and investing. Here's one. Know when to fold them. You've heard that refrain many times, I know. See, good poker players fold a lot of hands. And when played this way, the game can be a bit boring, but it's a lesson investors need to learn in order to be successful. In poker, success is about making money, not winning hands. And because most hands are losing hands, it takes patience and discipline to protect your bankroll while waiting for a playable hand. In investing, success is about gradual accumulation of wealth over long periods of time. It's not the aimless pursuit of short-term gains. It takes patience and discipline to stick with a prudent long-term investing strategy when you really rather just be engaging in risky transactions because it feels so good to see immediate, adrenaline-producing results. But patient doesn't mean sitting idly by. Rather than characterizing sitting idly by as patience, poker players learn what is basically deliberate non-action. Because you never know when a favorable betting opportunity will occur, so you must be mentally alert and ready for action at all times. Even though not taking action is an integral part of the game and essential for your long-term range goal of making money. Now, I always say that doing nothing is an active decision, but I want to say that this does not apply to teenagers. Remember, doing nothing is an active decision. So here's another one. Know what you don't know. Poker players are required to make betting decisions based on incomplete information. Without knowing the cards in their opponent's hand or the community cards yet to be revealed, they must decide whether to bet, call, raise, or fold them. So investing also requires decision-making in the face of incomplete information. Sound familiar? What is incomplete information in investing? Well, it's the future direction of interest rates, of stock prices, and many other factors which affect investment returns. These can all be analyzed, but in the end, they're simply unknowable. Given imperfect information, the key to success in poker and investing is to assess what is most likely to happen and base decisions on the most probable outcome. The third one I found was understanding human nature. You know, human behavior is an important part of poker. You're constantly trying to determine what is in your opponent's hands based on how they act at the table. An opponent who leans back in his chair or immediately reaches for his chips after looking at his hole cards can help a watchful player determine that the opponent has a good hand. It's called the tell. But what some poker players and some investors often ignore is their own behavior. People tend to underperform their own investments. You know, it's not uncommon for a mutual fund to go up, let's say, 10 or 12% a year on average, yet the average investor invested in that fund makes only 2 to 4% per year on average. Why is that? Well, it's human nature to buy when market is up and people feel good, and to get frightened and sell when things are bad. So understanding human nature means understanding our own behavior as well as others, such as staying in a bad hand or a bad investment out of hope, and not because the mathematical probabilities tell us it's the right thing to do. By the way, I'm talking about the parallels between poker and investing, and some of this info came from a really good book called The Psychology of Poker by Alan Schoonmaker. Here's another one, minimizing losses and maximizing gains. So there are four styles of poker players, and I love this. This is really important. The first one is a loose, passive player. And a loose passive player calls just about every bet. There's loose aggressive players. They call a lot, they play lots of hands, and they raise frequently. Then there's the tight passive player. Now, these are folks that are careful with their money. They seldom bet, rarely raise, and call only when they have a great hand. See, that's the tight passive player. And then there's the tight aggressive player. These really are the best kind of players. They're careful with their money, but when they do play, they seize the initiative. They enter few hands, but when they do, they bet and raise aggressively. So here's a question. What type of investor or poker player is Warren Buffett? Loose passive? Loose aggressive? Tight passive? Tight aggressive? Well, he's tight aggressive. He's careful with his money, but when he sees things that are in his scope of knowledge and the price is right, he bets heavily and most often makes a fortune. And here's the final one, controlling your emotions. Losing your cool in poker is about going on tilt and leads to irrational play. Likewise, investors who let emotions interfere with good strategy also make bad decisions. As the experts say, the most important decision in poker and investing is always, what is the right next thing to do? A client who has a bad investing experience must be careful not to let the emotional fallout affect his decision. If he finds that hard to do, a temporary retreat to cash, which is the equivalent of sitting out a few hands, may be the best strategy. And of course, poker players and investors should never risk money they can't afford to lose. So, wrapping this idea up, the analogy between poker and investing is fun, and it helps to illustrate some fascinating points. But remember that to create real wealth, you have to treat your money seriously. Poker is just a game. Investing is serious business. It's a lifelong process that determines whether or not you'll live in peace and comfort. And this is the most important financial stuff you can know. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. In a crowded business world where everyone is vying for our short attention spans, being very different from your competition is the key, and branding is one of the most important ways for businesses to break out of the crowd. Not only businesses, but also for us as individuals, personal branding is another important tool to help us get what we want from this crowded world. Julie Cotino is founder and CEO of Brand Twist, a brand consultant and creator of Brand School Online. And prior to launching her own business, she was vice president of brands at Richard Branson's Virgin Group. Her new book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Build Breakthrough Brands. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
You mentioned in your book, Twist, you describe a pivotal moment when you were in the airport that changed your perspective and gave you a new vision. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was at Newark Airport and I was traveling as a brand consultant and I was running for my plane and frankly, not really enjoying the whole business travel experience. I find it very bland, very me too. And all of a sudden I was stopped in my tracks by the image of a 747 with McDonald's golden arches on the tail fin. And in that moment, I thought to myself, wow, that's a different kind of airline. You know, I bet that airline has a very service-oriented attitude, maybe bright colors, maybe a menu of options. Maybe I could get on the plane, see it was crowded, and supersize my economy seat to a business class seat or first class. And I started getting really excited about this airplane. And I realized all of a sudden that it was a mirage. It was actually the reflection of the food court on the window of the neon McDonald's sign, and there happened to be a plane parked there.
What did that mean to you when you saw that? What flashed in your mind that got you moving in their direction?
I just had such a big aha that the way to really break out in any category is to take off your brand blinders, to forget about what your competition is doing, look at brands that you love that are breaking through, that are doing well in other categories, and use or twist those best practices.
You say brand blinders. So you think most people, most business people and individuals walk around and they just take on too much of a me too attitude? You mentioned dentists in your book.
Yeah, I think in every category, you know, it's not like they're making a mistake. I think it's natural. It's just that you live and breathe your business, you're looking at your competition, you're reading certain trade publications. For a lot of small businesses, you're spending a lot of energy trying to look legitimate. And often that means inadvertently sounding and looking and promising the same things as everybody else.
So if I'm a small business person and I have a limited budget, how do I start thinking about this seemingly creative exercise that I'm going to have to develop? Maybe I have someone helping me with logo and so on. How do I do all of this? How do I get from point A to the point where you want me to be?
Yeah, I think the first thing is you have to just become a student of brand. And I don't mean, you know, textbooks or classes or something complicated. I mean, just start to notice which brands you as a human being, not necessarily as a business person, are noticing. You know, where are you getting great customer service? What are the brands that you are raving about, that you're telling your friends and family that they need to try? And then really look at what are those brands doing specifically, not just in terms of their logo and messaging, but their whole experience. And then thinking about what could you beg, borrow, and steal to incorporate into your own brand.
So what can we learn? I mean, there's a lot of great iconic brands in our world, and these are brands that have been developed over, in some cases, over 100 years or more. I'm thinking of Coca-Cola and the like. Give us a takeaway that we can learn from a Coca-Cola or an Apple or a Virgin.
Yeah, well, Virgin obviously is a brand near and dear to my heart. And I think one of the smartest things that Virgin does is they look at the brand experience as a continuum. So they don't just think about your airline experience as the time that you're on the plane. For Virgin Atlantic, for example, it starts, they pick you up, they drive you in a limousine to the airport, they make it easier to check in. They have a different kind of clubhouse experience. You know, on the plane, they have a different approach to entertainment. They have a bar in the middle of upper class, you know, a real bar where you can sit and have a drink and chat. And then when you land, they'll take you to your destination. So it's all of those little touch points, large and small, that we should be thinking about as business people. What are the moments of magic what I can surprise and delight my customer?
It sounds to me, though, you're talking about the difference between a brand and a business model. I think in my own mind, what you've just described to me is a business model of heightened service, extra service, something special. But is that the brand that a small business person is thinking, or is that a business model?
Well, it's a great question, Stephen. In my mind, they're the same thing. Your brand is your business. And the number one mistake I see large and small clients making is they think that their brand is just their logo, their name, their website. You know, one of the things that I encourage my students and clients to think about is from the very beginning, how can I build in branded elements, magic moments to my business model so that if what you see is missing in your category is customer service, you know, don't just add that on in the end with a tagline that says we care, you know, really build it into the way the business is structured. That's brand.
Find the need and fill it is what my daddy used to say. And I think it follows that theme. My guest is Julie Cotino. She is the CEO of Brand Twist and also Brand School Online. She was also the vice president of brands at Richard Branson's Virgin Group. Her book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Breakthrough Brands. Let's talk about personal branding, Julie. You mentioned that you think you should start thinking about your brand really early on in junior high school or something.
Yeah, I do. And I have two teenagers, one who's in college and one's a sophomore in high school. And it's really hard to get into college these days. There's just so many different candidates, you know, vying for the same spots. So I think early on, you have to start to think about your own personal brand narrative. You know, what am I going to write in my essay that helps this university who has a split second to look at each application, understand me, get me, and want to know more about me?
Yeah, I'm thinking about Legally Blonde right now and the video that she sent. That made an impression on me. I don't want to go there. So millennials in particular, you mentioned that they've really got to figure out how they're going to get what they want from this world. What are you suggesting to them at their later ages?
Well, one of the great things about millennials is they're digital native. You know, they're really good at social media, Facebook, Twitter, Vine, whatever it is these days. So curate your content. You know, make sure that what you're putting out there is telling the story that you want to be out for potential employers. And I also think editing is really important. You know, a lot of millennials have grown up with so many different talents. You know, their parents are, you know, asking them to get involved in sports and arts and, you know, community service and all these different things. And that's fabulous. It's creating really well-rounded people. But as an employer, it can be a little overwhelming to understand somebody. So, you know, I suggest you pick one thing that you're passionate about. You know, for my daughter, it was music, but she used her community service was around music. She did work in a music therapy institute. She worked as a music TA at our synagogue. You know, her thesis for her senior paper was around the idea of music in literature. So you can make it well-rounded, but if you make it well-rounded and focused at the same time, then people are going to understand your personal brand, your story, a lot easier.
That's very good advice. The book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Build Breakthrough Brands. My guest is Julie Cotino. Julie, is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, they can go to brandtwist.com.
Brandtwist.com. And of course, to find out more about Julie, to hear this segment again, don't forget to join us and join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Julie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, interest rates have come down recently. Actually, the 10-year Treasury, which is the benchmark for a lot of things that we use money to borrow on, or the borrowing rate is set on, I should say, is around 2%. So I was wondering what the mortgage market was doing, and I invited an old contributor to our program, Alan Robinson. Alan is here. He's a managing director and founder of First Trust Mortgage. He's been a mortgage banker for 36 years, all of which has been in South Florida. And as I said, he used to be a frequent contributor to our program. So who knows best about mortgages than Alan Robinson? Hey, Alan, welcome back.
Hey, Steve.
All right. So we're seeing this benchmark rate, this 10-year treasury that we all watch, is just hovering around a little over 2%. And that's come down from the fourth quarter of 2018, where it got up to almost 3.25%.
Yep.
And people were freaking out. Market took a big dive. So where are, let's just start with the easy stuff. Like, where's your typical conventional 30-year mortgage rate today?
Typically right now, Steve, for the good customer, somewhere around 3.99%, just slightly under 4.
You know, when I saw these numbers before we went on air, I was kind of surprised that they were still what I think is relatively high. Is it just that it's taking a while for those market rates to filter down?
Yes and no. We think, as the providers to the customer, that we think the rates are too high given where those treasuries are.
Yeah.
And we think the money lenders are actually have inflated rates just so they can make more money on a temporary basis. Most of the big boys are still losing money by originating residential mortgages.
That blows my mind. I mean, they're getting money at a certain rate. They're borrowing it to lend it.
Yes.
Banking's a great business.
Yeah.
And then they get to kind of lend 10 times as much as their equity. So it's even a better business.
Yes.
But you're saying that the way you're seeing the way they're pricing things is that their internal costs, they're losing money for every loan. These big providers, like these big banks, like Wells Fargo and Chase and all of those.
Yeah. The national average, Steve, is somewhere around $8,300 per deal. So what that takes into account is everything from client acquisition right through secondary market when you sell the loan to the servicing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's never been more expensive to close a loan.
Well, you know, you can't really stay in business very long if the business that you're doing is losing money on every transaction.
They subsidize it through different divisions of the institution.
Yeah,
so sometimes it comes from the marketing budget. Sometimes it comes from the high net worth clients. It comes from somewhere, but in that cost center, in that bank, they're losing money on those deals.
Yeah. When I worked for Chase in the early 1990s, it seemed like every division I came in contact with was losing money. And really, I was in the investment division. We were a new division, so we were losing money. Then I saw the mortgage business was, they were losing money. And I was thinking, man, those credit card divisions must really be raking it in. And I guess that's probably it.
Yeah. It changes cycle to cycle, but yes.
Yeah. So, okay, the 30-year mortgage with what, 25% down, 20% down is around 4% right now.
Correct.
And you see rates continuing to slide?
Yeah, we can see that Treasury getting down to 1.3, 1.35. We think there's
another.
Oh, well,
no. I mean, if the Treasury stays the same, do you think
we
that
still
rates
think
will
rates
come down?
Will come down.
Yeah.
So we think
there's
those
no
margins
way,
will
there's,
change.
There's no way that the 10-year Treasury is going to 1.3. That's wishful thinking on your part.
A lot of the analysts on our side of the ledger think that, and they look around the world to see what's going on and whatever.
Yeah.
They also look to see what they think the Fed's going to do given an election year coming up and a recession coming up, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I don't know. They must be, I think they're smoking something.
They could.
Because they're like they're in Colorado, aren't they?
You never know.
Look, if the 10-year Treasury goes to 1.3, we got more serious problems than people getting mortgages. Maybe mortgage rates will be down, but people won't be buying mortgages.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. So let's get down to the 15-year conventional 20% down or so.
Typically, you'll find that there's about a 0.25% difference between a 30-year fixed and a 15-year fixed. Those particular bond coupons aren't trading quite that much right now, so it's closer than it's been in a while.
Yeah, so normally there's a differential in the rate toward the 15-year, favoring the 15-year.
Correct.
So you're paying a lower rate.
Yes.
But of course, your payment is higher because you're compressing the amortization from 30 years to 15 years, so you're going to pay more. But the rate is lower. But you're saying in today's world, the differential is not that high.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And getting less. And we talked before about the 30-some-odd different things that go into determining a rate. Yesterday, I looked at a rate where the 15-year was actually more expensive than the 30-year, giving the loan-level adjustments for the rate.
Loan-level adjustments.
Everything costs you or gets you something. So loan-to-value matters, credit score matters, type of property matters. And when the computer puts all those factors in, the 15-year rate was more expensive.
Can you still get a mortgage without income?
Yes.
I mean, without a job?
No.
Well, I mean, there's retired people who have income
from
their portfolios.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
I'm going back to 06.
No, there's no income, no asset, no ratio.
The fog,
no
the mirror.
Doc.
There's
no.
None of that.
No, the only person that would get that back to the different channels of business would be on the hard equity side.
Meaning?
Where you put 30% down, you pay a 10% interest rate, 2 or 3 points.
The guy around the corner.
You wink, wink, say it's your investment property and you're not going to live there. Things like that.
Those are basically short-term loans.
Yes, typically a year or less.
Right. And you can pay up to about 10% or something on that.
Correct.
Generally.
Interest
so
only
it's not the loan shark. But it's just a kind of a person-to-person transaction you need money fast, you can't get to the bank, that's too complicated or whatever reason, you go to somebody who will lend you, you know, half of what the value of the home is, let's say, for a year, and they'll charge you 10%.
Correct.
That's a different channel, as you called it.
Yes.
Okay. What about those loans that are adjustable loans?
Hardly any adjustables are happening right now, Steve, with
really?
The exception of the jumbo business, and that's few and far between. The rates are just so good.
You mean the 7-1s, like the rate is fixed for 7 years, and then it starts to become variable afterwards annually, or the 5-1s, those are not popular or they're not available?
They are available. There's just not enough margin for the customer to say, why should I take that risk if you're only going to get a 0.25% difference or 0.375% difference?
Yeah. And a common sense, though it's been wrong, would be that, you know, rates can only go up.
Correct.
Because they're so low. So why take the risk that in 5 or 7 years, rates will be higher when you can lock in the rates today?
And if you'll go back, we had talked about it before, 15 years ago when those pay option arms were out there.
Yes.
The rates were wonderful forever, still are wonderful. But what happened now with history is that the 10 or 15 year adjustment is now happening.
Mm-hmm.
The people owe more money than what they had borrowed. The amortization now is at 15 years versus 30 years, and their payment goes up by 40%.
Well, that's what starts recessions. That's what started the housing crisis. To a large degree.
That's why we're thinking there is a recession coming in 2020.
Well, that's how you get to 1.3%
10-year
rate.
And 2 or 3 Fed reductions.
Okay,
right?
Never mind. really quickly, how easy is it to get a loan these days?
Steve, it's never been easier and it's never been harder all at the same time.
Your hair is a lot grayer.
You know, you said the 36 years, which is scary, but I would tell you that the person who is perfect, who is totally organized, who is totally automated, who is on their game, they know passwords, usernames, they're wired, it's never been easier for them to get a loan. They can walk in and press buttons and I'm done. There's not a lot of those people. The majority of us don't know our usernames and passwords.
You still need your tax returns?
Maybe.
Maybe. Statements, bank statements?
Possibly.
W-2?
Maybe.
What do you mean?
Well, here's where technology came in. And the first thing that happens is back to the environment is that I'll say to you, Steve, do you do online banking? You say yes. I say, great, I'm going to send you an invitation. And when I send you that invitation, it's going to allow you to access your bank statements. Don't send me any of them. Give it permission.
Uh-huh.
It will give me your average deposit, how much money's in the account. I'm done.
Got it.
Same thing with IRS transcripts.
Okay.
You file tax returns. Yes. I get a 4506T. I verify your transcripts. I don't need tax returns.
Okay.
You work for IBM?
Got it. All right. So when I said, do you need those things? You still need those things, but you don't need me to give you paper copies and stacks and folders and things like that, or even upload them because you can now get access directly to the bank accounts.
Correct. Okay. The automation's there.
That's fine.
But there is a segment, there is a channel called, back to what you and I called subprime years ago, is now called non-prime.
I love that.
You come in and you
non-prime.
Say, you say, Alan, look, I don't pay all my taxes. I make $10, I write off $9, I pay $1 worth of tax, but I really make $5.
Okay.
Do you put that money through your bank account? Yes. I have a program, and I don't mean I when I say
yes.
I, the industry has a bank statement program.
Yeah.
Even though you don't pay taxes on the money, if you put 10 grand in your bank, you take 10 grand out, I could underwrite based on 10 grand.
Okay.
So there's asset depletion. You got $1 million in the bank. I can assume you take out X amount of dollars a month. I can do your loan for you.
Okay. So, well, that's a big improvement because there was a time when the system couldn't cope with this idea that people, not everybody has W-2 income.
Correct.
You're self-employed. Your income is variable. It's this and that, but it's still income. You're still living. You're still got your IRA SEP or whatever, your 401k. You're living a normal life. But it's not conventional.
Correct.
Okay, but that's changed. So the technology has come a long way, I guess you're saying.
Yeah, it's never been better. And as long as the users know how to use it, being the loan officer, the processors, underwriters, it's never been easier.
So if I can't supply my passwords and this online capability, what, do you come in my house?
Either or. The industry's really made a committed effort because look at Quicken, for example. They came in the industry 10 years ago. We never thought that they would be around. They're the biggest lender in the country.
Yeah.
And they're remote.
Yeah.
So they have no choice. You better do it their way or you're not their customer.
Yeah.
On the local level, with most mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, direct lenders, you say, customer, where are you at? You computer or you're not?
Yeah.
Your printer doesn't have ink or it does. You haven't been on your Wells Fargo bank account recently? Come on in or we'll come to your house.
Right.
That's gotcha. Where our advantage is over the virtual lenders is that we can be local and be the expert.
Gotcha. We're out of time. But I think we've learned a lot about the mortgage industry, especially we know where rates are and how some of the behind-the-scenes thinking goes. My guest is Alan Robinson, Managing Director and Founder of First Trust Mortgage, and he can be found at borrowsmart.biz. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Steve.
To hear this at any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. By the way, we love to get your questions, so don't hesitate. We will answer them, we promise. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update that includes all of our upcoming live events and important topics that we cover on this show every single week into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one, and a blue one, and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
A few weeks ago, we talked about this term staging.
Yes.
And I wanted to go through this again because I know how important this is. The impression that you make, you only sometimes get a first impression.
That's right.
I guess the first staging stage is online and the photographs that you're showing.
Photographs are critical. You know, Steve, it's kind of fun, actually. If you go through, you know, go online, look at some houses and just look through the photos, you can tell a professional photo from somebody's inexpensive, I don't know what they're using, cameras with their fingers in front of the thing and
bad lighting
on the bed and the bed unmade. Would you want to go see that?
No, but I've said this before. You can tell a professional picture when a 10 by 10 room looks like the ballroom at the Boca Raton Hotel.
That's right. Okay. So that's going the other extreme.
But it is important to make your first impression really, really wonderful. Now, if they come to your house, what are they expecting to see? And what is a detraction from your main goal, which is to sell the place?
Sure. Well, absolutely. The first thing anyone has to do is declutter and clean. I cannot emphasize that. You can have an old home with all kinds of, you know, formica, old small tile. You know, everyone's looking for the newer, nicest stuff.
Yeah.
As long as it's clean.
Yeah, clean.
Clean, clean. When you go to sell your car, you declutter it.
Yeah.
You get, you know, it detailed, right?
That's right.
It's the same thing here. So you want to show pride of ownership.
Yeah. Well, the thing too, though, is you're still living there. So you have to adopt a policy of cleanliness and declutterness with your family and set the law.
Yes. And, you know, there's a house I'm putting on the market this week and they've been working at it for 6 weeks. They've, you know, gone to the dump multiple times. They've decluttered, donating things. So it's a process. So when you make the decision to put your home on the market, make sure you factor in the amount of time it's going to take to have your house show ready.
Okay, good. Declutter and clean. That's a simple one, but one that people don't necessarily follow. Here's another one. Depersonalize.
Yes, that's really important. You don't want all your trophies on the walls because they're your trophies. That's personal. Personal photos. It's okay to have like one or two, but sometimes you go into homes and it's collages of walls of, think of it, if you were a buyer, would you want to see that? You want a clean canvas. You can't put yourself in that environment. You don't see yourself there because it's so well marked by somebody else's belongings.
Of course, if you take the pictures off the wall and there's like—
Then you got to patch them.
You got to patch them, you got to paint them.
Yes, that's
right?
Why you need 6 weeks. Oh, another killer, light bulbs.
Oh.
You know how many different color light bulbs there are, Steve?
Yeah. You know, when you don't really think about that, but you just go get a light bulb.
Yeah,
and
no.
Like to go to Home Depot now and but to buy a light bulb.
It's a process. It really is.
It's really. There's so many choices.
So many colors of amber and different shades of white. I didn't realize.
Yeah, and I'm colorblind. So it's a nightmare for me.
Yes. Buy all new light bulbs. Make sure they all work and they're all the same color.
All right. What about furniture? You know, you've got, you know, your favorite chair, your, right. You know, but it may not really be ideal.
Well, the customer I was just speaking about, who just has been prepping the house for 6 weeks. I told them, we moved furniture around to make it more spacious. We took the big lazy boy and we put it in the garage, you know, because it blocked the walkthrough mm-hmm. the family room. So you want to take that into consideration. One of the things that I really like doing is removing the floor rugs.
Why?
The reason why is it shrinks the room. So when you walk into a room and it's all the same tile and it looks great, and then you have the floor rug in the whole living area where the furniture is, it makes it look smaller.
It chops it up.
Chops it up. You know, your eyes, it's just a psychological thing.
Well, your eyes follow a line, and if it's breaking the line, then it has a different psychological effect.
Okay. Yeah. All I know is the rooms look a lot bigger without the floor rugs, so can them.
Now, in extreme cases, if you're selling a very high-end home,
yes,
and let's say there's kind of little to no furniture in there, does it make any sense to go in and rent furniture temporarily, almost like a model when you go to buy a model?
Yes, it does, Steve. As a matter of fact, a lot of the sellers, agents up north are telling us that they are professionally staging their homes, bringing in furniture. They're spending, you know, a fair amount of money to do so because there's so much competition up there right now. Everyone claims they're all moving to Florida, but apparently there's a lot of truth to that. So when you come down to, say, our neck of the woods and you're dealing with people that are in the Northeast and they're staging their homes and they look beautiful, and then they come down to our homes, you really need to up your game a little bit if you're looking to get the highest and best price possible for your home.
All right. So let's say you're selling a home in the 3 to 5 million plus range, let's say, and it's really not an updated home. I mean, would you go and put new countertops down, do something that extreme, or are they doing that at all?
Yes, I would, depending on what your competition is, and your realtor would have to advise you whether or not it's a good idea or not. If all your competition is newer homes and yours isn't, well.
Yeah, well, okay, sure.
You need to, one way or another, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah.
You're going to either lower the price to match the condition, or you're going to raise the condition to match the price.
I know for me personally, I kind of want a home that's done. I don't really want to be living through the nightmare of remodeling, but I'm, you know, that's just my feeling. A lot of people don't really mind that.
Well, to be very honest with you right now, that seems to be a big feeling that most people are having. They don't want to take the time to go through it. And if you try to find a contractor right now, because we've talked about other articles where people are staying in their homes longer, they're deciding to renovate and stay put.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the contracting business, you got to be doing really well right now.
Yeah. This is the time. This is the time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. My guest is Chris Mackey. He is the founder of Solutionomics, which, according to the website, is an independent, nonpartisan platform dedicated to developing and disseminating solutions for creating a more dynamic American economy. Chris Mackey has also advised the U.S. Federal Reserve. He's a contributor to the Beige Book, which is an important item in the Federal Reserve's platform. And he writes for The Hill, which is a nonpartisan publication following the workings of Congress, etc. Chris Mackey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Steve. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
You know, it's hard for me to discuss anything that has to do with politics because there's so much partisan wrangling with every word that's written or every word that's spoken. And so I'd really just want to, you know, and I know that with your publication, you know, you are neutral and nonpartisan. We are the same here. So let's just try to concentrate on the facts and look at the facts only, if that's okay with you.
That would be great.
All right, let's talk about global trade. So you wrote in a recent column that the U.S. has pursued basically a free trade, I would call it maybe an open door policy, saying, you know, free trade will benefit all. So we really just want to try to promote this idea of everybody trading as free as possible. And yet we know that countries negotiate on their own behalf. As a matter of fact, the president acknowledged in a speech at the World Economic Forum saying that he expects countries to act in their own interest. So give us your thoughts about that. And then I think his strategy, obviously, is in order to fix this, is the tariffs. And I'd like to hear how you think that's going.
Happy to. So something clearly needed to be done. In 2018, 13 of the 15 largest economies we traded with sold more goods to us than we did to them. So think of it this way. If we were an NFL team, that means our record would have been 2 wins, 13 losses. So something needed to be done. And part of the reason for us losing in the game of global trade is just as you mentioned, you know, we're proudly carrying the banner of free trade, and free trade, global trade can be very good for the global economy. But we need to make sure it works for the U.S. And what has happened is that while we're pursuing free trade policy, historically, other countries have not. And so that has put us at a strategic disadvantage. Now, part of the reason why we've let that happen is that trade has been used in the service of foreign policy.
Yeah.
So that's the first issue. Mm-hmm. It's a myth that everybody wants free trade and they're not going to try and get an advantage. So we have to first deal with that myth if we're going to make an improvement. Now, as far as tariffs and the effectiveness of tariffs, you know, tariffs are, they're not like a Swiss Army knife. You can't use them in every situation and they're not effective in every situation, but they certainly have their use and can be effective. You know, as an example, past administrations like President Reagan, he used quotas, actually, in relation to Japanese auto vehicles, and that had some positive effects. My approach would be to use tariffs strategically and selectively rather than broadly. It would be to indicate to the business community that, look, this is what we're going to be doing over the next 5 years. What that would do is that would give businesses time to plan. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have the dislocation of the supply chains. You also wouldn't create as much investor angst. But then you also need to make sure that if you do implement tariffs, that you're covering all the countries of the world, not just one. So you're not just playing whack-a-mole. Now, having said that, there actually is another approach that would be better than tariffs. And that's very simple, which is tie each company in the U.S., tie the corporate tax rate that they pay to their rate of job creation. Why is that an approach that I'm advocating? Because then what you do is then you're not getting into a trade war. And two, you're providing a real concrete incentive for companies to increase hiring in America, which is the goal of the tariffs that the president is implementing. So that would be a different approach. Or if nothing else, I would at least do that in concert with the tariffs. But I would just take a little different approach.
Let me understand this. First of all, when we're buying goods from overseas, I guess the expectation is that they're manufacturing these goods at much lower prices. So basically, while we're paying more and giving them more money, hence the deficit, we're importing lower prices, which helps the consumer. So it's kind of complicated. And I am not an economist by any means, but I mean, I have read that. So if, in fact, the U.S. worker is more expensive, so it's, you know, it's cheaper to go abroad, it's too expensive to manufacture at home. Is this idea about giving a tax rate benefits to the employers a way of reducing the cost of higher wage workers?
It's a way of making our companies and producing in the U.S. more competitive. So there is a labor cost differential. Now, part of what is left out as it relates to the lower cost of goods to consumers is that there's also a kind of an unnoticed cost, which is that, you know, when you have the Verrazano Bridge in New York buying steel from China, and I forget if it's the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco from China, what that does is you get cheaper steel, but then you also have less employment in the U.S. So it's not a simple, hey, you know what, we're getting lower priced goods, so that's good for American consumers. Yeah. That puts downward pressure on wage growth in the U.S. So as you pointed out, it's not a black and white. It does get complicated, but we need to start accounting for some of those costs of the cheaper goods from overseas, because if I'm getting paid a lower wage or I just don't have a job, those quote-unquote cheap goods are actually very expensive to me.
Yeah, if you don't have money, everything is expensive. You know, General Motors just announced they're laying off 14,000 workers. And in one of your articles, you wrote that they still, of course, got the benefit of the big tax cut last year. And I think what you're saying is that your idea would be to say, hey, you don't really get a tax cut if you're now going to turn around and lay off 14,000 workers. It kind of goes against the sense that the tax cut is supposed to give companies more money and give them an opportunity to take that extra money, invest it in the economy to create more jobs. But you have a company like GM, which is actually doing the opposite. Where does that fit into the spectrum?
Well, it fits into the spectrum of missed opportunity. And, you know, I come from a background of ROI, or return on investment. So that's the framework by which I evaluate things. And so, again, while something needed to be done to our tax code, it was a missed opportunity, because what they could have very simply said was, okay, if the return that we want is more American jobs, then simply make the tax cuts conditional for each company on actually increasing hiring. Instead, what they did was they had a universal and unconditional tax cut. So companies creating jobs would get the cuts, companies firing Americans would get the cuts. And again, coming from a background of return on investment, that was just not the best approach. And they simply could have said, look, companies, you increase hiring, you're going to lower your tax rate. If you don't, it's just going to stay the same. It's really just that simple.
You know, but here's the problem I have with that. I don't understand how a company can just create jobs. I mean, the jobs are there based upon the amount of business that's done and the cost of doing business and all that. You just can't like wave a magic wand and say, because I'm getting $3 billion back from the government in taxes or something like that, that I can start to create jobs. I don't see how the two come together.
Well, based on that premise, then we should have never done the tax cuts. Because if what you said is true, but I don't necessarily disagree with it, then cutting the tax rate would have had no impact on job creation, so there was no point to do it.
I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, you make an interesting point. So what I'm saying is I'm trying to bridge the gap between those who believe that if you cut taxes, that will generate more jobs, and those who are skeptical and believe that companies don't create jobs just because they've got a lower tax rate, and there's real validity to that. I'm trying to bridge that by using a concept from my background in finance called an earnout, which says, okay, you believe if you do something, cut taxes, that's going to create more jobs. I'm skeptical, so let's do this. If you actually create more jobs, we'll cut your tax rate. And if you don't, then we won't. Mm. And that's how you bridge the gap between those two different philosophical views.
Okay. Well, you know, unemployment, the June numbers were announced, and unemployment shot up to 224,000 new jobs, what I'm saying is, new jobs were created, which is a terrific number. So when you look at the amount of jobs that are being created in 2019, 2018, it does seem like overall, I don't know if it's due to the tax cut, but overall, the economy is doing extremely well. How would you look at that 224,000 in some historic light?
Sure. Well, I think what's important to keep in mind is that we're still adding a robust number of jobs. I mean, 170,000 a month, especially at this late point in the cycle, that's a good number. That's an ample number for the economy, and we'll keep the economy going.
That 170 is the average for 2019, right?
Yes. Thank you for clarifying. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So for the first 6 months of 2019, we've been adding about 170,000 jobs a month. And so that's good. Now,
right.
Some people say there's a concern because we were at 223, but what you have to look at is that that 223 was artificial. That was due to fiscal stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, most people didn't expect that to be maintained. What we expected was we'd go back basically to the future or to 2017 and go back to where the job growth was prior to the fiscal stimulus. So the economy is doing what it should be doing right now, is going back to a more sustainable level.
Yeah. Okay. So that's good news. You know, let's look at some of the other news. Inflation is very tame. Now, I started in the investment world in the early 80s, and actually came in and, you know, 2.5 year CDs were at 16%, and
yep,
30-year treasuries were 13%, and inflation was 10, 12, 14%. And now this idea, you know, inflation is at 2%, and, you know, that Fed's actually worried about deflation just seems still such an oddball thing to me, because all we ever wished for was low inflation. So we have that. We have low inflation. Interest rates have remained extremely low. The 10-year treasury is about 2.1% now. I remember there was a time when we never thought it would get to 5% or to 7%. And now it's been hovering around this 2% level for so many years. We have good job growth. We have good economic numbers. And yet, here's what my question, you know, I work with a lot of individuals and investing money, and the stock market's been rising, and nobody really believes it. Nobody is happy about it. Everybody is waiting for the next crash or next shoe to drop and so on. I don't know any bull market that's ever died on such pessimism. What do you think about where we stand right now?
Well, it sure is an interesting environment. So the one thing I would like to point out is that, you know, we've got the job growth. We've got decent wage growth. It's come down a little bit, but, you know, that was to be expected. Yes, manufacturing is slowing somewhat. Yes, global growth is slowing somewhat. There is trade policy uncertainty. No, but we still have an expanding economy. And so it seems like the choices are always, oh, we're going into a significant equity market decline tomorrow, or the stock market is going to continue going up for forever. And the reality is that if you look at the economics of the situation, in the stock market, as long as things keep going the way they are, should have decent earnings growth. Now, should we be setting records? What I can say is that I'm not comfortable with an environment where we're setting stock market records with a market that is so heavily dependent on a Fed rate cut.
Yeah.
That's actually the biggest concern I have, is that this market is just, it's got a high degree of dependence on a Fed rate cut. Mm-hmm. And that does not give me a lot of confidence in the market, because theoretically, if the equity markets are that strong, you shouldn't need a Fed rate cut.
Yeah. Well, you know, the market so far is up about 18% this year, plus or minus, depending upon the day, of course. I had a kind of a bad May and a terrific June and now July. So, you know, I guess dividends are still rising with the underlying stocks. Even international stocks, with all the bad news that seems to be going on about them, those international stocks have done pretty well. So, I mean, do you expect some kind of disaster right around the corner?
No, certainly I don't expect a disaster right around the corner. What I do expect is that we're going to have continuing volatility, because the markets are going to be buffeted by continuing trade policy uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do get a Fed rate cut in July, you know, that the markets will love that. Although, interestingly, that would indicate that the Fed sees some headwinds in the economy.
Right.
So I'm not quite able to reconcile those two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even after, if they do get that Fed rate cut, you know, they're still going to be faced with the reality of earnings and what those look like. And the reality that, while still okay, the economy is slowing both domestically and globally. And what are the implications of that for earnings?
Well, Chris, we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. Chris Mackey is founder of Solutionomics, which you can Google and find his great site there. And you can follow him as well on Reading the Hill and other publications. To hear this and any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, as you know, and join our conversation. Ask us any questions that you may have. We love to answer your questions. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, where you'll get in your inbox every single week just a one-pager saying what we've discussed, and you can listen to the entire show, you can listen to one segment, or just read the segment, or read the full transcript. It's up to you, depending upon your interest and time. Don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. Chris, once again, thank you so much.
Certainly been my pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.